This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Marjorie Cohn draws parallels between the recent arrest by the Russian government of journalist Evan Gershkovich and the Julian Assange case.
I will point out the hypocrisy of the Biden administration in decrying Russia's imprisonment of a U.S. journalist, but going full speed ahead with the prosecution of Australian citizen Julian Assange.
We explore the question, has the U.S. morphed into a society of narcs? Josh Reeves discusses his book Citizen Spies, The Long Rise of America's Surveillance Society. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
May 3rd marks the 30th anniversary of World Press Freedom Day, established by the UN to remind governments about the necessity to respect their commitment to freedom of the press. The Biden administration touts press freedom, but continues the Trump administration's efforts to extradite Julian Assange from the UK to the United States for trial on Espionage Act charges that could lead to 175 years in prison. Assange is being prosecuted for obtaining and publishing classified military and diplomatic documents evidencing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is the first publisher to be charged under the Espionage Act for revealing state secrets. The Biden administration hypocritically criticizes Russia for arresting Evan Gershkovich, a U.S. journalist, for espionage while trying to extradite and try Assange, who is an Australian citizen. Both men are journalists detained in a foreign country on espionage charges for doing what journalists do. This is Heidi Boghossian, and today I interview fellow Law and Disorder co-host Marjorie Cohn, who is a member of the National Advisory Board of Assange Defense. Marjorie is professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Her new article about Assange and Gershkovich was just published by Truthout. Marjorie Cohn, welcome to the interview chair on Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks so much, Heidi.
Marjorie, why did the Russian government arrest journalist Evan Gershkovich, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal?
Well, on March the 30th, Russia arrested Evan Gershkovich, a Wall Street Journal journalist, a U.S. citizen based in Moscow, for practicing journalism. Gershkovich is now incarcerated in Russia, where he's facing espionage charges that could result in 20 years in prison. And Gershkovich's appeal to lift his pretrial detention was just denied, and he was refused a consular visit. The Russian Federal Security Service, or FSB, announced that it had detained Gershkovich and alleged that he was, quote, acting on instructions from the American side to collect information about the activities of one of the enterprises of the Russian military-industrial complex that constitutes a state secret, unquote.
How did the Biden administration respond to Gershkovich's arrest?
Biden's press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, said in a statement, quote, "We are deeply concerned," unquote. And she added, quote, "The targeting of American citizens by the Russian government is unacceptable. We condemn the detention of Mr. Gershkovich in the strongest terms," unquote. In addition, Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell issued a rare joint statement calling on Russia to immediately release Gershkovich. Quote, "Journalism is not a crime," unquote, they wrote.
Meanwhile, journalist and publisher Julian Assange has been locked up in London's maximum security Belmarsh prison for 4 years now, while the U.S. government tries to extradite him to the United States. What is the basis for the charges against Assange?
The indictment against Assange is based on WikiLeaks' revelation of the Iraq war logs, which were 400,000 field reports that chronicled 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians and the systematic rape, torture, and murder after U.S. forces handed over detainees to a notorious Iraqi torture squad. The indictment stems as well from the release of the Afghan War Diary, 91,000 reports of a larger number of civilian casualties committed by coalition forces than the U.S. military had reported. In addition, the indictment is based on the 2007 collateral murder video, which depicts a U.S. Army Apache attack helicopter targeting and killing 11 unarmed civilians, including two Reuters news staff and a man who came to rescue the wounded, as well as the wounding of two children. That video contains evidence of three separate violations of the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Army Field Manual, in other words, war crimes. And finally, Cablegate consists of 251,000 confidential U.S. State Department cables that disclosed corruption, diplomatic scandals, and spy affairs on an international scale. According to the New York Times, the documents revealed, quote, the unvarnished story of how the government makes its biggest decisions, the decisions that cost the country most heavily in lives and money, unquote.
The Trump administration filed the indictment against Assange. The Obama administration, which prosecuted more whistleblowers than all prior U.S. presidents combined, considered charging Assange but decided against it. Why didn't Obama's Justice Department indict Julian Assange?
Obama's Justice Department, that is Eric Holder, who was the Attorney General, were cognizant of what came to be called the New York Times problem. Holder convened a federal grand jury, a secret grand jury at the time, to determine whether or not to charge Julian Assange and indict him. And of course, as you said, the Obama administration hardly hesitated in indicting whistleblowers under the Espionage Act during Obama's tenure. But they decided that because of the First Amendment freedom of the press issues, Assange being a journalist, that if they were to indict Assange, they would also have to indict the New York Times, the Washington Post, Der Spiegel, etc., other news outlets that had published the same documents that WikiLeaks had released. So ultimately, the Obama administration made the decision not to indict Julian Assange.
Joe Biden, who was, of course, vice president in the Obama administration, could have dismissed Trump's charges against Assange when he assumed the presidency. What has Biden's administration done to Assange since taking office?
The Biden administration, the Department of Justice, vigorously pursued and continues to pursue the extradition of Julian Assange from the UK to the United States. He has been locked up in a maximum security prison, as you said, for 4 years. And the magistrate judge in the UK denied the Biden administration's request for extradition. Actually, at the time, it was the Trump administration's request, and the Biden administration continued that request for extradition. And the magistrate ruled that because of the psychological torture that Julian Assange had suffered, and this is documented by UN special rapporteurs, when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy in London under a grant of asylum, meant that he is in very fragile mental and physical health. And if he were extradited to the United States and held in a maximum security prison in virtual solitary confinement, that he would very likely commit suicide. So based on the record at this three-week extradition hearing, the magistrate judge in the UK denied the U.S. request for extradition. Well, the Biden administration could have dropped the case at that point, but they appealed the denial of the extradition request and came forward with so-called assurances that if Julian Assange were sent to the United States, were extradited, that he would not be held in this Florence, Colorado maximum security prison or subjected to special administrative measures virtually keeping him in isolation. However, these assurances contained a huge loophole, and that is, if the prison authorities decided that Julian Assange had committed an offense worthy of keeping him in these conditions, then all bets were off. And in addition, the U.S. government has reneged on these so-called assurances in the past in a case involving Spain. The Biden administration could have produced these assurances during the extradition hearing. The U.S. government could have come forward with them, but they didn't. They waited until the magistrate denied extradition, and then they said, oh, by the way, we're giving you assurances that he's going to be treated humanely. So the High Court in the U.K. bought those assurances that the U.S. government came forward with and reversed the magistrate's denial of extradition. So that's what happened, and then there are a number of appeals, and instead, at any point, the Biden administration could dismiss the indictment that the Trump administration filed against Assange, could withdraw the request for extradition, but the Biden administration is going full speed ahead trying to prosecute and persecute Julian Assange.
Marjorie, on November 28, 2022, five leading media outlets called for the dismissal of the Espionage Act charges against Assange. What did they say?
They said publishing is not a crime. On November 28th of 2022, the New York Times, The Guardian, El País, Le Monde, and Der Spiegel signed a joint open letter urging the U.S. government to dismiss the Espionage Act charges against Assange for publishing classified diplomatic and military secrets. And they wrote, quote, "Publishing is not a crime," unquote, adding, quote, "The U.S. government should end its prosecution of Julian Assange for publishing secrets," unquote. In 2010, those five media outlets had collaborated with Assange's WikiLeaks to publish Cablegate, which, as I said, was one of the bases for the indictment against Assange.
On the fourth anniversary of Assange's arrest, seven members of the U.S. Congress sent a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland. They urged the Department of Justice to drop the charges against Assange and withdraw its request to extradite him from the U.K. to the U.S. Upon what did the legislators base their request?
Well, these Democratic Congress members included Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, Jamal Bowman of New York, Cori Bush from Missouri, Greg Sassar from Texas, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York, Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, and Ayanna Pressley from Massachusetts. And they sent a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland urging the Department of Justice to affirm the First Amendment's protection of freedom of the press by dropping the charges against Assange and withdrawing the U.S. request for extradition from the U.K. And they wrote, quote, "Press freedom, civil liberty, and human rights groups have been emphatic that the charges against Mr. Assange pose a grave and unprecedented threat to everyday constitutionally protected journalistic activity, and that a conviction would represent a landmark setback for the First Amendment," unquote.
Several leading human rights organizations and experts have also called for the dismissal of charges against Julian Assange. Please explain.
The seven Congress members who wrote that letter to Merrick Garland quoted a letter that was signed by the ACLU Amnesty International, Reporters Without Borders, Human Rights Watch, Defending Rights and Dissent, and the Committee to Protect Journalists. And those groups wrote in their letter, quote, "The indictment of Mr. Assange threatens press freedom because much of the conduct described in the indictment is conduct that journalists engage in routinely and that they must engage in order to do the work the public needs them to do," unquote. That conduct includes regularly speaking with sources, requesting clarification or additional documentation, and receiving and publishing documents that the government considers secret. And the human rights groups noted, quote, "Such a precedent in this case could effectively criminalize these common journalistic practices," unquote.
Moreover, lawmakers around the world have urged the U.S. government to cease its prosecution of Assange. Who are they?
Well, the Congress member's letter also cited opposition to Assange's prosecution from these lawmakers throughout the world, including Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, Brazilian President Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, and Argentinian President Alberto Fernández, as well as former UN Special Rapporteur on Torture Niels Meltzer, as well as Council of Europe Commissioner for Human Rights Dunja Mijatovic. The U.S. Congress members also referenced similar letters from legislators from the U.K., Australia, Germany, and Brazil.
Marjorie, while Julian Assange was living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, the CIA and the Trump administration made plans to kidnap and to assassinate him. Can you please explain?
WikiLeaks exposed the CIA's hacking system of electronic surveillance and cyber warfare. It was called Vault 7. The CIA called the expose the largest data loss in CIA history. Mike Pompeo, Donald Trump's CIA director, labeled WikiLeaks a non-state hostile intelligence service. CIA and administration officials made secret war plans to kidnap and even kill Assange, according to an explosive Yahoo News report published 2 months before the UK High Court's ruling. Senior CIA and administration officials sought sketches and options for assassinating Assange. And Donald Trump himself, quote, asked whether the CIA could assassinate Assange and provide him options for how to do so, unquote, according to the Yahoo News report.
What have the UK courts done in the Assange extradition case during the last 4 years? And if you will, what is the status of Julian Assange's appeal?
Well, as I said, Heidi, the magistrate granted extradition based upon the risk of suicide if Julian Assange were incarcerated in the United States. The UK's High Court reversed that denial of extradition after the US came forward with these so-called assurances. And Assange is currently appealing additional issues to the High Court, aside from the suicide issue, and that is that he is being extradited for a political offense in violation of the extradition treaty between the United States and the UK. And so his request to the High Court to review these additional issues is currently pending in the High Court. It could go to the Supreme Court of the UK and ultimately could go to the European Court of Human Rights. Meanwhile, Julian Assange's health is deteriorating daily. People who have visited him say that he is in very, very frail health, and these appeals could take a number of years.
How can our listeners help in the ongoing efforts to free Julian Assange?
I would direct people to AssangeDefense.org. That's AssangeDefense.org. And if you go to the events page, you will find a listing of all of the events around the country that will mark May 3rd, the World Press Freedom Day, with events in support of Julian Assange. Also, AssangeDefense.org contains other ways that people can get involved in this struggle to free Julian Assange.
And Marjorie, before we let you go, how can listeners follow your work?
Well, I write a basically weekly column on truthout.org. It's under the heading Human Rights and Global Wrongs. Also, all of my articles, books, TV, radio, video interviews are collected on my website, marjoriecohn.com.
Marjorie, it's always great to have you in the guest seat on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much for your important work, your writing, and also your efforts to raise awareness about the Assange case.
Thank you, Heidi. I really appreciate it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security's program, If You See Something, Say Something, launched in 2010, urges citizens to be aware of and to report potential threats. Examples of suspicious activity include unattended packages or luggage, circumstances that may appear out of the ordinary, like an open door that's usually closed, a person asking for detailed information about a building's layout, and changes in security protocol or shifts. Also of concern is any person seen loitering around a building, taking notes, sketches, photographs, or measurements. The DHS website is careful to note that, quote, factors such as race, ethnicity, and/or religious affiliation are not suspicious. Yet, as most listeners know, incidents of ethnic profiling are many, including one in which a Southwest Airlines passenger was removed from a flight just for speaking Arabic. The history of citizen spying and reporting on others is not new in this country. And the See Something campaign isn't the only civilian spying program around. Many jurisdictions have neighborhood watch programs. The U.S. Department of Justice's National Neighborhood Watch initiative enlists community members to assist crime prevention and to prepare neighborhoods for disasters and emergency response. Joining us to talk about his book, Citizen Spies, The Long Rise of America's Surveillance Society, is Joshua Reeves. Josh is an assistant professor of new media communications at Oregon State University. He's also written the just-released book called Killer Apps, War, Media, Machine. Josh, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi. Great to be with you.
You write in your book, Citizen Spies, that vigilance toward neighbors has long been aligned with American values of patriotism and moral duty. What do you mean by that? And also, how did the Trayvon Martin case demonstrate this?
Well, Heidi, I think that this is really one of the more interesting dilemmas in the American experiment. You know, in a society like ours, that tends to value limited power of the state, and you don't really have any strong police presence until the middle of the 19th century, and in some places, maybe even most places, not until much later. It's really thriving on a sense of a rugged independence where you don't have a need for the state, no need for the police. It's thriving on this individualism, and what this comes along with is a sense of self-entrepreneurism. But I think this entrepreneurism really gets played out in the community in a lot of interesting and sometimes strange ways. And that's where, for me, the really interesting tension is. If you have this classic American small government philosophy, a basically libertarian ideology, and you don't want the police, you don't want an intrusive state, then in essence, you have to become the police. And so there are obvious problems with police power. We all know what those are. But in a society like ours, you know, if you don't have the police, you have to turn yourself and your neighbors into cops. And so anyway, you know, that's where we get some of these problems, is in the attempt to try to turn everyone into auxiliary cops in different forms. And I think with Neighborhood Watch, you often see that vigilance and that prepped individualism. And the question becomes, you know, how do you display that? How do you enact that prepness, that rugged individualism? And I think that a lot of times it tends to happen on the public stage in your own neighborhood, you know, by choosing a certain group of people that you're responsible for and that you can prove that you're responsible for. You know, maybe it's your family or it's your block, whatever locality in which you live. And then that vigilance, that individualism tends to get embodied in surveillance and suspicion. And that's something that we see with what happened to Trayvon, unfortunately. You know, but again, I really don't want to pick on Neighborhood Watch, and I really don't even want to pick on George Zimmerman. But, you know, this is an illustrative site where the cops, they openly recruit folks, where they train folks to act like cops. And they try to teach them nonviolence. They try to ensure that they don't carry weapons, to respect the state's monopoly on violence, all these different kinds of things. But, you know, sometimes it does backfire. It obviously, I think it's at least obvious to me that if you teach folks to act like cops, sometimes they're going to cross that line into violence. And that's the risk for with programs like that. So, I don't really think it's necessarily a problem with an individual like George Zimmerman. It's a larger social and political issue in the history of American politics.
Well, you know, I just think of police procedurals where you see groups of individuals who object to, say, someone on the sex offender registry moving into their neighbor, and then vigilance turns into harassment or worse. And I think that no matter how many problems the police have, they are at least accountable, or on paper at least, to the strictures of the Constitution. They can be sued, but citizens, it's kind of like the Wild Wild West and a cowboy mentality in certain cases, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. And, you know, again, it's easy for us to point out individuals like Zimmerman or individuals who would be frustrated with a sex offender, for example, moving into their neighborhoods. But these are really structural issues, as I think your answer gets at. And it's a problem with the way that we handle crime. It's a, you know, I mean, obviously a million different structural issues that contribute to this. But I think it's a recurrent facet of the way that Americans deal with risk and that they deal with personal individual responsibility to themselves. And then, of course, you know, to their families and to their communities. It's through this vigilance and suspicion.
Josh, you mentioned Neighborhood Watch, but your book talks about many other examples of early citizen spying. Can you cite a few of those and explain how they came to be?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that I pointed out a minute ago is that America really didn't have anything resembling an official police force until, you know, the mid, late 19th century, and some places later than that. You have some colonial town watches. But what I really think is interesting is to flip way back into history and see how this has been used as a mechanism of social control, in essence, and to see the extent to which our situation reflects or does not reflect those old traditions. And so if you look back to the Norman conquest, one of the things that I point out in the book is that the Normans, when they invaded the Anglo-Saxons, they started to hold all Anglo-Saxons in a given village responsible for crimes that were carried out within that village. And so unless the local Anglo-Saxons would serve up one of their community members for a particular crime, they would all be held responsible for it. And so what it did is it instituted this vigilance that you constantly had to be sure that you would be able to find criminals and that you would be able to put them up for certain kinds of punishment to the Norman authorities. And so I feel like baked into this is this sense that the state is using us in different ways to help enforce its prerogatives. And again, sometimes those are noble, but sometimes it does come down to a sense of what you might consider to be social control, of getting us to police one another so that, in our case, the liberal state doesn't have to over-police. And so in the book, I look at a number of instances of this. I look at the history of 911, which, when this is new on the scene, you have to, in essence, teach people how to use this new technology. You have to teach them to be vigilant so that if they see something, that they actually say something. I also look at Neighborhood Watch, which we've already discussed, and I look at a number of youth programs and contemporary anti-terrorism programs, like if you see something, say something. I really think it's a recurrent phenomenon, especially in American history.
Now, let's go back to what you just mentioned, the role of children in what so-called civic spying. Describe that to our listeners.
Well, I think most of your listeners are probably going to be aware of it already. I mean, you know, I think that this is one of the most interesting twists in this story. And in New York, you know, you have a number of early 20th century programs. You have something, a program developed called the Junior Copettes. And you know, this is gendered in interesting ways because girls are looking at different things than the boy junior police are looking at. And so, you know, the copettes are making sure that grocers are selling fresh produce, for example. The boys are looking for crimes. And so it's the prerogative of a lot of, especially urban police departments, to send kids out into the community to police their neighborhoods, but also their families. In D.C., you see this with a lot of African-American kids toward mid-century in the 20th century to work as police auxiliaries. These are programs, in many instances, to, you know, these get kids off the streets programs. And so what they do is they, in order to turn them into better citizens, they have to instill in them this police ethic, this always be vigilant, always be watching out for what's going on in your communities and even in your household. And so you see a lot of different versions of this. Some of the more contemporary ones that we're familiar with are things like DARE, which teaches kids, despite their protestations, to narc on their parents, obviously. And this is what I really think is interesting, and it shakes things up, is that especially with youth, this tends to generate resistance cultures where the kids will fight back against this. And so you know this with trends like stop snitching or snitches get stitches. So there are all these tensions where, you know, kids don't just go along with this, just as the same, you know, adults don't either. They tend to fight back in various ways against these programs that teach them to fulfill their civic responsibility through spying and snitching on their neighbors and families.
You know, Josh, I never heard of the copettes before.
Yeah.
It is interesting. One of the, I guess, pitfalls of all of this is that the definition of what is suspicious activity. So that with surveillance in general, we know that when people know they're being monitored, they tend to sort of self-censor what they do. And I think society loses as a whole because innovative ideas, things that aren't seemingly meshing with the status quo may be discouraged because they look different. That's a frightening concept to me.
Yeah, for me as well. And I feel like before you had digital technology, before you had video camera technology, I feel like this was one of the main reasons that you have programs developed like this, so that people understand that there is constant pressure to conform their behavior to expected norms. And so you can look at this in the 19th century or in the early 20th century, where now we can rely on video cameras or we can rely on Google or whatever, whatever kind of monitoring you have for your school or at your home for, you know, for children, whatever it happens to be, you can rely on those things to manage folks' behavior so that they act in accord with how you want them to behave, or so they're afraid to act in certain ways or to say certain things. Before that, you know, where did that pressure come from? And that's through really diffusing these policing responsibilities to members of the public before we handed over that capacity to media technologies.
You talk about an interesting phenomenon, crowdsourcing community response, and how that serves the police. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, especially in early village life in the United States and in other places as well. But, you know, the book really focuses on the United States. And people would use whatever kind of notification technologies they had on hand in order to spread the word about crimes that were ongoing, or that in order to tell people that there were criminals in their midst. You know, cops, police agencies, sheriffs, you know, depending on what era we're talking about, they've always tried to diffuse responsibility for crime control so that they can, in essence, spread their presence throughout a community. And, you know, police departments, sometimes they can use this, if you imagine America's Most Wanted as a television program. This is an attempt, a pretty visible one, I think we're all familiar with, of the state to try to spread that responsibility out for crime control, to publicize serious crimes typically. But cops, especially in the age of social media, have changed this a little bit, and so they're doing it for more petty reasons. They're doing it to enforce fines for things like DUI and failure to appear, drug offenses, all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, oftentimes they'll give out rewards. And if you're listening to this right now, you can check out your local PD, look at their Pinterest, look at their Facebook, the other social media accounts that they have, and see how they're trying to crowdsource crime control and if they're offering any kinds of rewards. And, you know, oftentimes they'll post pictures of folks that you can look out for in the community and make sure that you call 911 to report them. So, yeah, I feel like, you know, crowdsourcing has been there since the beginning, and we're starting to see some interesting iterations of that in the social media age as well.
Now, I thought it was fascinating in that same vein. You note in the book Citizen Spies that police are finding ways, and that includes using kill switches, to ensure that crowdsourcing isn't turned on them. As our society becomes, through social media, equally aware of police misconduct, how does that work?
Yeah, I think that that's actually one of the most interesting things. What I was discussing earlier with kids rebelling against this, you know, with developing anti-snitching cultures, you know, people are going to rebel against these moves by the state to try to recruit folks into becoming cops or into providing information. So, you know, cops have always found ways to manipulate technology to control how they're interacted with. So you've got kill switches now, you know, which perhaps will shut down certain smartphone activity within a given geographical area. But, you know, it's always been there. And that's one of the reasons why I talked about the development of 911 emergency, is because you can see how these media technologies that people were using in order to communicate with the police, in order to bring police attention to different matters, how the police took really special care to manage those as closely as they could and to regulate them. And so at first you had 911 call boxes where folks could, only certain trusted people could enter them because only certain people had keys to unlock them. And so the cops didn't really trust the population to call 911 at the beginning. And so now, of course, if you call 911, they know exactly where that call is coming from. They know who you are. They've been trying to carry out surveillance on people in order to, and if that privilege is misused, in order to retaliate against them or, you know, prosecute them for whatever charges might be relevant in the given instance. And so I do think that technology becomes this interesting way in which the cops not only spread responsibility, but in which they police that responsibility in various ways and make sure that it's not being turned against them. That's one of the main imperatives, of course, is ensuring that you're not wasting the police's time and that you're also not going to use it in order to bring attention to police misconduct.
When you talk about the 911 telephone number. You know, I never thought of it as a form of citizen reporting because I thought it was couched in a helpline if you need help, which of course it does in so many life-saving situations. But on the other hand, when people are calling to report, you know, noise complaints, petty crimes, it does serve a very different function.
Yeah, it certainly can. And you're right. You know, I mean, it has a bunch of uses that are certainly socially valuable, and you don't want to ignore that. But of course, you know, as with all of these things, they come with considerable promise and they come with considerable downsides. And that's one of the things that I'm looking at are, you know, what are these downsides and how have they been policed? I mean, the same thing happens with similar measures. You know, it's not 911, but, you know, the social distancing narking hotlines that y'all have, for example, in New York right now. We have them obviously across the country. You can look at how ambivalent these things are, that perhaps they have a positive function. Even a lot of progressives and folks with interesting politics are offering that right now. But, you know, there are considerable downsides to having people report their neighbors for whatever is going on. So, again, even if these things do have some important potential politically and socially, they're also abused. And that's inevitable. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, was to look at the downsides to this, how they come along with a lot of political baggage. What's the effect of that?
Josh, do other countries employ the same kind of citizen spying as the United States does?
Yeah, you know, obviously the book is on the United States. It's what I immersed myself in. It's what introduced me to the problem. But, you know, I think it's a pretty deeply ingrained tendency of state power to operate in this way. You know, the classic examples that people tend to use are, you know, East Germany with the Stasi and turning everybody into citizen spies and all this. You hear it today where people are singling out China, you know, as being especially authoritarian and having this citizen spy ethic. But, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote the book is that I wanted to say, look, this is also a perhaps unavoidable facet of liberal societies as well. Societies like ours, you know, I think it's a pretty well-ingrained impulse that's hard to get away from, not only in authoritarian societies, but also in liberal ones. So I trace it back, I think, probably more fundamentally than sort of putting the blame on liberalism or on authoritarianism, but it's a question of how state power tends to be distributed. And you can see that historically, as I pointed out, even with the Norman Conquest, this is sort of an age-old tactic by which representatives of the state are able to exert their influence across large sectors of the population.
Josh, talk, if you will, for a few moments about misinformation and misidentifications. And also, do you know how many citizen tips come in annually? I suppose because there's so many ways for them to come in, it's difficult to even gauge a number.
Yeah, I would really hesitate to put forward a number because there are so many different programs nationally. They're for different purposes. You know, what would you include in a number like that? You know, would you include a high school that has set up a tip line so that kids can narc out fellow students? Are you talking about counterterrorism? You know, there were some numbers that were available in the years following 9/11 when they were keeping an eye on the fusion centers and the kinds of data that different local police departments were getting when they would get tips about a potential terrorist attack coming in. So, you know, the numbers are really difficult to get a hold of, but I do think that, you know, with this deluge, I mean, we can be sure that the tips are at least following 9/11, you had thousands a day. I was looking for numbers the other day for New York's tip line for social distancing, and I couldn't find any hard stats. I'd be interested to hear if y'all have a better idea than I do. But it sounds to me from the response, at least publicly, they're implying that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these a day. As far as misidentifications and misinformation generated by this, I mean, there's all kinds, and there's quite a few examples. You have the Boston Marathon, bombing, which happened in 2013. And surrounding that, there was a lot of folks on social media, including Reddit, and they attempted to investigate their local communities and find out, oh, is this the bomber? Or is this the bomber? In the days between the bombing and when they actually found the suspects. And there was someone who was misidentified as being the bomber, and unfortunately, his family found him several days later having committed suicide. Everybody's wondering, oh, he's disappeared, and he sort of looked like the person on the video camera footage, but it ended up just being some random person. There's also a story I tell in the book of a Pakistani college student in Michigan who's walking across his apartment complex in a college town with a pressure cooker, you know, to cook rice. But of course, after the Boston Marathon bombing, everybody thought for the next couple of years that anyone who's walking around, especially if they look, you know, Central Asian or Middle Eastern, that they must be terrorists if they have a pressure cooker. And so, you know, these kinds of things have a pretty big impact. But I also want to say that it's it would still be a problem even if these misidentifications never happened, right? Even if they were 100% accurate, I think the social and political impact of having us all be vigilant toward one another would still be perhaps the greater threat than these occasional, if, you know, maybe even frequent misidentifications. I feel like it's a deeply ingrained social problem that we have. Does that make sense?
A total sense. And I just wanted to add that with the probably millions of tips that come in, we see this with federal law enforcement and terrorism intelligence. They're so overwhelmed with information that they miss important leads. And even the database programs that they've developed to sift through or use algorithms to find this are just swamped with extraneous, useless, and oversaturation of data. So I think we're suffocating it with data overload.
That's one of the most interesting facets of this, is that they have no way to synthesize these data in a meaningful way. They have no way to make sense of all of these tips. And so you have to look beyond the value of the intelligence itself to see the real political utility of this. What's the real political value of having us all snitch on our neighbors and be vigilant in our communities? And it's sort of identifying with the police. And if not identifying with the police, then identifying with a certain policing mentality and taking that on in our everyday lives. If the intelligence value that we generate itself is not in the end all that valuable to the intelligence agencies, there's some other political value to it. And I think that's what a big part of this is just instilling in American citizens a sense of vigilance and civic responsibility through spying and snitching.
Well said. We have a few minutes remaining. I want to ask you a big picture question, Josh. How do you think, if it's possible, that as a nation we can dispel the mentality of seeing enemies everywhere in our midst?
Can we? that's a different question than should we, isn't it? I think it's a really complicated question. And again, I feel like it's something that's deeply ingrained in state power, even in liberal societies, perhaps even uniquely ingrained in us as liberal citizens. And so I feel like, you know, the answer to a lot of these structural issues is to do what you can, but, you know, it's also to carry out the work of working on oneself, in essence, and trying to be a better citizen who can relate to your neighbors without being snitches. But again, look what we're seeing with what's happening with COVID. We're being told that people are our enemies, even if they don't know they're our enemies. You know, the unknown element with terrorism or with pandemics, you know, it's so powerful, especially today, that I think we're in uncharted territory. I think this is going to change a lot with surveillance and a lot with vigilance as being directed toward folks that we see when we're out at the shopping center or if we're at the grocery store, or if we're just walking around our neighborhoods. I feel like that impulse is just so strong. and that, you know, the police and state allied state agencies, they've become so good at turning us against one another that I think it's going to be really difficult to rebel against these things. But, you know, that's not to say that we need to be, you know, hopeless about it, but I think we really need to work on ourselves and try to relate to one another in ways that don't require constant policing and constant suspicion. I think that's the best way to do it. But as far as the larger public, I'm not sure I have a great answer to that. What about you? I mean, do you have any ideas for a better way we could manage this?
No, I think that the powers that be like to pit us against each other, as you've suggested throughout your answers, that we're a law enforcement society, puritanical in many ways. So I think that we become cynical, sadly, in ways that I think modern technology is also helping to reinforce. And I wanted, on that note, to ask you about your courses in new media communications at Oregon State University. How does what you teach relate to the topic of this book?
So I have a couple of classes that deal with surveillance because there's really no way to talk about, at least from my perspective, to talk about media in a theory class or in a media and society class, which are the classes that I teach most often, without discussing new media. And there's really no way to talk about the economics of new media or the politics of new media without talking about surveillance. So we talk about these issues, whether it's domestic surveillance with its police surveillance, maybe it's the NSA. We also talk about drone surveillance and military surveillance. So I think that these questions are absolutely crucial to understanding where we are from a technological standpoint and also from a social and political standpoint. And so I absolutely engage these questions from a theoretical and practical perspective in my courses and trying to get students to think about some of these things that they've been handed down, if it's these civic responsibilities where they feel the impulse to narc on one another, even on campus, or if it's a more general question about, you know, how do these devices impact us in such a way that it allows for us or even encourages us to develop these kinds of ethics toward one another? Because it, as you were hinting, Heidi, I mean, there's something about the technology itself that tends to plant these seeds in our behavior and cultivate them as we become more acquainted with them and as they become a bigger center of our lives and our social space.
Josh, you have a new book out called Killer Apps, War Media Machine. Congratulations, and can you just give us a sneak preview of what the book is about?
Absolutely. Thanks for bringing that up, Heidi. It is. It was written with my colleague at the University of Toronto, Jeremy Packer, and one of the things that pushed me to do this was that I had been looking at surveillance as being completely human-generated in citizen spies, where I was really interested in how the police and other agencies had used citizens, activated their civic responsibility, really, through surveillance, through spying on one another. And so I had enough of the human for a while, and I wanted to see, okay, how is surveillance carried out in other ways? And so I decided to apply that to the military context with Dr. Packer. And so what we're looking at that is really the automation of military surveillance and military attacks. How does that process of looking for enemies and identifying enemies and then attacking those enemies become automated? And so it's the link between surveillance and attack. And that's what we look at. We trace out the history of the development of automation in military technology, and then we try to give a glimpse of what this is going to look like in the future.
I want to share a little secret. While we were preparing to link you in for the phone interview, our producer Jeff Brady and I were talking about the cover of Citizen Spies, which is absolutely phenomenal. We'll post it on our website. And same thing for the Killer Apps cover. You have great titles, great designers, and great books. And I think that in a month or so, we'd love to invite you back on the show to talk more about your book, Killer Apps, maybe with Dr. Packer as well.
Oh, Heidi, we'd love that. Yeah.
Great.
And unfortunately, I can't take any of the credit for the covers or the titles. But no, absolutely. The folks at NYU with Citizen Spies did a terrific job, I think, as did our cover designer at Duke. They tend to do great jobs, both of the presses, and I'm really impressed and happy with what they did with those. But hats off to those folks.
Two great presses, by the way. Well, we're so happy to have spent some time with you, Josh. I want to thank you for getting up early on the other coast to join us. We really want to encourage our listeners to get a hold of Citizen Spies. I think right now, as you've said, during the pandemic, it is such a timely read. So thank you for your important contribution to the field.
Oh, Heidi, thanks so much. I mean, obviously, thank you for all the work that you've done and you continue to do. I'm thrilled to be on, and I look forward, I hope, to talking to you again soon about killer apps
yes.
and anything else we've been discussed.
As do we. So be safe and have a great day.
All right. Be well, Heidi. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Sometimes. Baby, don't love me no more, girl.